From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. A Massachusetts gun advocacy group is suing to overturn the state's 1998 assault weapons ban. What does current case law say about how much states can regulate weapons? And we'll preview Governor Baker's State of the Commonwealth address tonight. We'll also take a deeper look at one of the promises Mayor Marty Walsh made in his State of the City address last week.
I can announce a plan to bring cutting-edge traffic light technology to Boston's busiest streets.
A traffic engineer tells us how that would happen and if it would make Boston streets safer and more efficient. Also today, Boston victims speak out on an evil hidden in plain sight, child sex trafficking.
It can happen to anyone, to any family. I was taking my daughter to a friend to go to the mall. She was put on Backpage and sold, kidnapped and raped.
It's Radio Boston, first the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Governor Charlie Baker gives his second State of the Commonwealth address tonight, and he's doing so at the halfway mark of his current term, and while also facing the considerable challenge of crafting a relationship with President Donald Trump. Now, we'll have live special coverage of the governor's speech beginning tonight at 7 right here on WBUR, but joining us now from the State House with a preview of the governor's address is WBUR's Steve Brown. Hi there, Steve.
Hi, Meghna.
So what do we expect to hear from Governor Baker tonight?
Well, the governor's address is always an opportunity for him to set the table for the upcoming legislative session, to highlight his goals and objectives, and to look back on the past year. So expect him to strike a bipartisan tone, praising the collaboration that he's had with Democratic legislative leaders over the past 2 years of his, the first 2 years of his term. He'll be highlighting the differences in tone here on Beacon Hill compared to the more contentious tone in Washington. Now, he told me yesterday he intends to take a victory lap of sorts over some of the successes that have been achieved by citizens, possibly in the areas of trying to stem the state's opioid problem. Of course, the opioid bill was one of the major pieces of legislation that was passed last session. He's also pretty proud of the relationship his administration has had with local governments, and he'll likely talk about how the municipal reform bill that was passed last year has helped cities and town governments become more efficient.
So quite a comprehensive speech we have to look forward to. Steve, we were seeing reporting from the Globe today that the governor is also expected to announce a request for some $37 million in additional money for Bridgewater State Hospital. Now, explain what we know the governor hopes to do with that funding.
Well, it was brought upon by the death of an inmate at Bridgewater, Joshua Messier, who his death put that institution under the microscope. Correctional officers were trying to put Messier in a four-point restraint when he suffered a fatal heart attack back in 2009. Now, while it's called a hospital, Bridgewater falls under the Department of Corrections and is run as a secure prison first and a mental health institution second. So the money that the governor is requesting will be used to bring in an outside firm to provide more specialized mental health services and security at that facility.
Okay. Now, of course, there's the whole of the rest of the governor's legislative agenda. We're getting quickly into the season where there will be battles over the budget. Do you get a sense amongst the legislature itself that there's an appetite for what Governor Baker might put forward in his budget?
Well, there's a bit of a strain beginning to show between the governor and the legislature, especially surrounding the budget. As you may know, the legislative leaders and the governor have been at odds over this year's budget and how much, if any, should be trimmed from it. The governor has implemented a so-called 9C budget reductions to many programs. That's something that he can do unilaterally without the legislature's okay to keep the budget in balance. But legislative leaders have been saying, wait, not so fast with those cuts. They're hinting that they may restore the money with a supplemental budget. And if you do the math, there are more than enough votes in the legislature to override a gubernatorial veto should one be issued. So expect the same disagreements over spending in the state budget for the fiscal year that will begin on July 1st.
Interesting. Now, Steve, as we noted at the beginning of our conversation, Governor Baker is entering the second half of his term. So put tonight's speech in a bigger context for us. What do we think is at stake for him going into the 2018 election cycle?
Well, he certainly doesn't want to see his favorability numbers fall. Now, they're still pretty high. The WBUR poll that was out this week show him with 59% favorability. That's good for a Republican in a Democratic state, but it's still down 10 points from this past June. So he has a little bit of wiggle room there. But the Democratic legislature may soon send him a legislative pay raise bill this week. It would also raise the pay of judges and constitutional officers, including the governor, that will present Governor Baker with sort of a Hobson's choice. He can sign it and take a hit from the public and see those numbers dip maybe closer to 50%, or possibly below. Or he could veto it and risk compromising the favorable relationship he needs with the Democratic legislative leaders in order to get his own objectives passed. So as 2017 gives way to 2018, his reelection year, as you pointed out, Governor Baker will want to have a long list of accomplishments to boast about at next year's State of the Commonwealth Address.
That's WBUR Steve Brown speaking to us from the State House. He'll also be covering tonight's State of the Commonwealth Address. Steve, thanks so much.
Thanks, Magna.
And just as a reminder, we will be hosting live coverage of the Governor's State of the Commonwealth Address, and it'll be right here at WBUR beginning at 7 o'clock tonight. Now, it is speech-making season amongst elected officials, and you'll recall that last week we heard from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh when he delivered his State of the City speech. Now, the end of his address, there was this one little soundbite.
I can announce a plan to bring cutting-edge traffic light technology to Boston's busiest streets. New signals will adapt to traffic in real time and work together to keep it flowing.
Cutting-edge traffic light technology. It sounds great, honestly, but how would it actually work? And what would this technology look like? We wanted to know. So we brought back our traffic expert. That's what I'm calling you now, Peter Firth. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northeastern University, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Magda.
Okay, so cutting-edge traffic light technology, what is it? What's the city planning?
We aren't sure what the city's planning because right now what they're doing is studying what they might get. But what's available in the market for cutting-edge traffic technology isn't that exciting, to tell the truth.
It's not? Oh.
It's not much different than what we've had for the last 40 years, which is traffic lights that follow a certain cycle. There are some detectors to make it responsive to traffic somewhat, but not as responsive as we'd like it to be.
But the mayor was saying that new signals would adapt to traffic. Is that what you're talking about in terms of like the in-street detectors to see what cars are where and change patterns that way?
There's real-time adaptation, and then there's adaptation over like a 15-minute period. The real-time adaptation is what you see in a left-turn lane when you see, oh, as soon as there's a gap, the light changes. That's real quick. That works really nice. The adaptive, what he's talking about, is they collect data over every 5 or 10 minutes, and then based on that, they might adjust parameters a little bit. So you're doing now what you wish you had done 10 minutes ago, and it's not responsive in real time. You can still have these situations where there's 20 seconds of green time for a street when there's no traffic on the other street.
Okay, so to be specific, the mayor says new signals will adapt to traffic in real time, end quote. So he's using adaptive and real time together.
Don't blame him. That's the standard terminology in the industry. But adaptive is not the same as real-time responsive.
Okay, but the mayor does say that these new traffic light technologies would actually keep traffic flowing. Do they do that in cities where they've been installed?
They help a little bit. We have a different without that, what you have is a certain plan for the morning peak, another plan for the midday, another plan for the evening peak. With an adaptive system, because it's collecting data all the time, it will essentially allow you to have a new plan every 15 minutes. So if there's a sudden rush because of a baseball game gets out or an increased traffic because of the weather, it will respond to that and give you a plan that's adapted to the overall level of demand. So that's an improvement.
Okay. So just to be clear, I mean, because you have advised and worked with the city before, have you seen any proposals actually for the city of Boston?
Not for the city of Boston. It's something that's slowly been coming in Massachusetts. We have some adaptive systems in some of our suburbs.
Okay. So give me an example, whether it's in Massachusetts or not, of your ideal cutting-edge traffic light technology or smart street light technology? Where is it and how does it work?
The ideal one should focus more on what the real time, which is when I detect that there's nobody else coming, stop the light being green for the street without traffic and give the time to the other one. And the key to that is getting free from fixed cycle lengths. That's the since I don't know, 1950 or something, the way that we control traffic is we assign a fixed cycle length, and we say that way if we get a whole bunch of you know intersections in a row all in the same cycle, we can get a green wave, but it's a dream. We can't get good green waves except on one-way streets. So on our two-way streets, we're pursuing this dream of a green wave without getting it. And what that means is, let's say there's no traffic, but you're not at the end of the cycle. You got to wait another 20 seconds. And that's why we end up with what I call stupid traffic lights that won't change even when there's no traffic.
Okay. So are these like truly real-time systems that you just described, are they in use in any city that we know of?
Well, real-time use is used kind of everywhere. And Boston has a few. But they don't tend to put them on arterials where there's one light after another. If it's an isolated intersection, like you could see it at the corner of Green Street and La Martine and Jamaica Plain. You could see it in Milton where Adams Street meets Center Street. So there are a few places like that where you see so quickly, wow, as soon as there's no traffic, the light changes. The next one gets nobody has a long delay. It's really nice. But along our arterials, we have prioritized we want a green wave for those through cars. And if the new system they get still prioritizes green waves through cars, we'll still have dumb traffic lights that stay green even when there's no traffic.
Okay. So I guess what I'm trying to imagine, maybe you just described it, but I can't quite see it. So if you're not aiming for that constant flow, let's use Commonwealth Avenue because mm-hmm. it's so long and it connects to major parts of Greater Boston. Like if you're not having traffic move down the many miles of Comm Ave as efficiently as possible, how is any other option more efficient? Because there is so much cross traffic.
Well, so Comm Ave is a great example. It's a two-way road. If you make a green wave in one direction, you are going to have, in effect, a red wave in the other, where you're going to get a red light at every block. Nobody wants that. It's impossible to have a green wave in both directions. The best you can hope for is be able to get through two or three lights, then have a reasonably short delay, and then another two or three lights. And that's a pretty good progression. And that can be done without requiring the whole street to be on the same cycle, the whole street to cycle together. So you could have a group of two or three intersections that, because they have a lot of traffic, maybe they need 100 seconds to cycle. But the next group maybe only needs 80 seconds to cycle. And so the pedestrians don't have to wait as long to cross the street. The left-turning cars don't have to wait as long.
Right. How much would this cost? Nothing?
The real cost is with equipment, and the equipment that we have now, any equipment that we bought in the last 20 years, can run all these programs. So all it means is buying software. The other cost is buying detectors. So if you want to have a smart system, you need more detectors, but they aren't too expensive. You just install some loops of wire in the ground and bring a feed to the control box that's already there.
Okay. Is there any downside to your ideal version of a smart traffic light system?
No, none at all. Zero. No downside, but it means more staff time, more expertise to put it in. If all that matters is we just want the lights to go green, yellow, red, and not have two streets have green at the same time so cars don't crash into each other, you know, that's the minimum. Well, you could just – you set it up and you turn it on, you let it go, and you don't do anything more with it. And the staffing levels in Boston's transportation department are pretty low. And so there isn't nearly as much active management and improving of those signals yeah. as they'd like.
Now, Peter, last couple of questions. I mean, we are talking about a traffic system that is, you know, perhaps largely guided by technology, but it's used by humans, right? It's like
right.
we are the drivers are at the wheels of the car. I'm just wondering, are there any solutions, any options that don't require the use of technology that we could use to ease traffic problems? Okay, for example, the 25 mile an hour speed limit in the city of Boston.
Yeah.
Is that a good idea?
The 25-mile-an-hour speed limit is to improve safety. It's a good idea, but it's meaningless by itself. And that's actually another place where traffic lights can make a lot of difference. When I say it's meaningless, it's because there's no enforcement on a street like Commonwealth Avenue. Drivers will drive at whatever speed they feel comfortable, and I'm not saying they should. It's just that's what they do. We study this. That's what they do. A smart traffic signal system will reward you if you go 25 by giving you green lights, and if you go 35, you'll have a red light in front of you. So we can use traffic lights to give us the safety benefit that we're looking for.
Okay, but we still have the drivers who, you know, insist on thinking they'll get a green wave all the way.
But when the light is red, they're going to stop. So that's for instance, in downtown Portland, Oregon, there's a green wave at a speed of 14 miles an hour. The experienced bus drivers, they just cruise around 14 miles an hour. Car drivers who are new, they'll zoom and there's a red light. Then they stop. They zoom for a block, there's a red light. Then they stop. And nobody can go fast because there's always a red light in front of you unless you're going at the speed.
I guess I was just also hoping to hear you say that maybe just if we changed our driving culture, that would go a long way to alleviating traffic problems.
No. Drivers are selfish and will go as fast as they want to. But it's systematic. We can count on that behavior, and then we can shape it. It's pedestrians more that you need to worry about. Car drivers actually will stop with the red light. Pedestrians won't. And pedestrians will not stand there and wait for 60 seconds, 80 seconds, when there's no traffic coming.
Yeah.
So we have to adapt our traffic signals to people, not ask people to adapt their behavior in a way that we know they won't.
Well, I'm going to just hope that City Hall heard this. And maybe your phone will ring soon, Peter. Peter Firth is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northeastern University. It's always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Massachusetts Gun Owners Action League and other plaintiffs have filed a lawsuit challenging the state's ban on assault weapons. They argue that the ban is unconstitutional. The lawsuit also involves a directive that Attorney General Maura Healey issued in July that cracks down on copies or duplicates of forbidden guns, where gun makers alter a weapon slightly to comply with state law. But the tweaks don't limit how lethal those weapons are. So joining me now with more is WBUR legal analyst and former Massachusetts federal judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk specifically about the part of the challenge that includes Attorney General Maura Healey's expansion of the assault weapons ban. The AG's office defines the phrase copies or duplicates in a way that the plaintiffs say is unprecedented in the history of firearms regulation. Do they have a point? That's too broad.
Whether it's unprecedented, it seems to me it's not unprecedented because other states are trying to do the same thing. Whether it is too broad because it's hard to define is a legal question that a court is going to have to decide. But what's happened is that the statute, the federal firearm statute, which expired in 2004, listed certain specific guns. And then the Massachusetts statute followed along even after the federal one expired. What's happened, of course, is that manufacturers tweak it just a little bit. So, for example, the Aurora shooter had a ban, a firearm that was banned under the Massachusetts law, but there was a fully, you know, functionally equivalent one that he could have used. And so the Attorney General's trying to get at that.
Okay. Well, so let's hear a little bit of tape from the Attorney General herself. AG Healey spoke in September with WBUR's Anthony Brooks about the actions that she said gun sellers were doing that led her to make this change.
They made copycat versions of these assault weapons. They even went so far as to market on their website that these weapons were, quote, Massachusetts compliant. And when we saw that, we said, that's an absolute violation of black and white letter law here in our 1998 ban on the sale of assault weapons and copycat versions of those weapons.
Well, not to be too legalistic, Judge Gertner, but is it strictly a copycat if there are minor modifications to the weapon?
Well, the statute itself said we're banning these weapons and copies or duplicates thereof. So the question is, that's going to be a legal question. Are these, how far do you go before something is the beyond the functional equivalent of something else? Otherwise, you think about it this way. If it's appropriate to regulate these weapons, and in fact, 60 courts have upheld assault weapons restrictions, assault weapons bans, if it's appropriate to do so, what does the legislature do? Does it then list every conceivable version of it? Or does it do what the statute said in this case, assault weapons that are listed here and any copies or duplicates thereof?
Hmm. Now, when you said, did you say 60 courts?
60 courts. That's right.
60 state courts?
Federal courts.
60 federal 60 courts.
60 federal courts interpreting the Heller case, which is the Supreme Court case that made unconstitutional the banning of handguns.
For individuals,
that's right. Then when states did what Massachusetts did and applied them to assault weapons, 60 appeals courts have affirmed those restrictions. Now, that's a very broad statement. There are restrictions of different kinds, and the devil may be in the details.
Yeah, because Massachusetts has amongst the most restrictive
laws. That's right. The devils may be in the details. I mean, there's a core question of, do you have a right to, which this case raises, do you have a right to ban assault weapons under the Heller decision? And as I said, that issue actually has been resolved by 60 courts, but not yet by the Supreme Court. Then do you have a right to ban assault weapons that are named and copies or duplicates thereof? And what's the scope of that? That's really where the action is here.
Really? Because, I mean, you said there's also that earlier core issue about the Massachusetts assault weapons ban as a whole, right? I mean, the original 98 law, which the plaintiffs are challenging as unconstitutional.
Right. So you have to look at this as the core ban, which was assault weapons that I named in the following way, and they laid them out, the AR-15, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Then there are copies and duplicates thereof. The statute covered both the weapon and the copies, but up until now, there hasn't been enforcement of the copy provision of it, and that's what the Attorney General is doing.
But are you saying, though, that you don't see the plaintiffs as having any grounds to challenge the constitutionality of the state's assault weapons ban, the underlying law?
I think that, I mean—
Because that's what they're doing.
Yeah. There's no question they're doing that. They certainly have the grounds to do it because the Supreme Court hasn't spoken on it.
Do you think that's what's going on here?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe they want to get it to the Supreme Court?
No, there's no question about it. I mean, there's a famous quote from Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas in which they castigated the Supreme Court, their colleagues, for not taking any of the lower court cases for review. So clearly the plaintiffs here are hoping that a Supreme Court with a new member or a Supreme Court with new members in plural will now want to address this issue and deal with assault weapons.
Talk to me about timelines here. I mean, can we say with any, I guess it depends on the decisions, et cetera, but, you know, could we potentially have the Supreme Court looking at the possibility of taking up this case in a year, 2 years?
It's going to take longer. It's before the district court now, so that this would be, it has to be litigated before the district court. Then there's an appeal to the First Circuit Court of Appeal and then to the Supreme Court. So you're not talking about a decision in a year. Not at all. But listeners have to understand that Heller was only handguns for individuals. And even the Supreme Court this past term upheld a ban on a gun license for someone convicted of domestic violence. So there has been regulation about who may have guns, what kind of waiting period, et cetera. And most of that, all of it indeed, has been upheld, for the most part, I would say. Likewise, the assault weapons ban dealing with semi-automatic weapons has also been upheld in these 60 courts. The third category, not just handgun assault weapons, is an automatic weapon, and that has been banned and is unchallenged.
Right.
So we're really talking about this middle category.
So in the last couple seconds that we have, Judge Gertner, I'm still wondering about the nation's highest court here. Do you think that there's an appetite now? I mean, we've got an 8-member court at the moment, but to to listen to the castigation from the now late Justice Scalia. Do you think they're going to want to take up a guns case?
It's hard to imagine they would want to take it up when there's only 8 members. There's no question about that. So the question really is, when they go to their full complement of 9, will they take this up? Now, they didn't when Scalia was around.
Uh-huh.
So what future changes in the membership of the court will lead to future changes in this issue?
Well, that's WBUR legal analyst and former Massachusetts federal judge Nancy Gertner walking us through the legal implications of a new lawsuit brought by the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts that challenges the state's ban on assault weapons. Judge Gertner, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for asking me.
Time again for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the extraordinary lives of ordinary people in our community. Today, writer Alyssa Eli recalls the role of faith on the life of a man from Roslindale.
The farm Carmen Barletta was raised on in southern Italy grew tobacco and olives. Carmen had no aptitude for farming, but fortunately he had no interest either. He was the only one of his 5 siblings to go to college, and in the late 1940s, that meant leaving home for a monastery, 500 miles to the north. It was far. It was lonely. He was 12. Later in life, he talked a little about it with his son, John Barletta.
For the first 2 years, he saw nobody. And then, I think year 3, they allow you to have family come up. I don't think he actually went back down home to see everybody else, in year maybe 5 or 6. He never shared any of his experiences when we were younger. I mean, we knew he was in the monastery or he went to school, but not how it really affected him.
The uniforms were black cassocks. The beds were like boards. The meals were rice.
It was very tough. The monks that ran it were very tough on them. It was almost a military environment. You have to break them down a little bit for everybody to conform. They also had to, I don't know how much they practiced it, but self-flagellation. I think it was one of those orders, that was a little more strict and you had to beat yourself a little bit,
Carmen was there for 10 years and left with a degree in philosophy. This wasn't useful when he immigrated to Roslindale in 1968 and worked assembling computers for Honeywell. But it was useful when he needed to make a persuasive point with his 3 children.
The biggest thing I remember from my father, he was a lecturer. Like, he would lecture you and he would bring so many things into the conversation, from a biblical perspective, from, a moral perspective and whatnot.
His Catholic faith was paramount. It helped Carmen through separation from the old country and difficulties in the new. After he lost his job, he became a full-time family man, driving his grandchildren around, fixing his children's houses. He attended church daily and prayed the rosary with his wife.
He really did practice, the Beatitudes of Christianity. Tried to be humble, tried to do good, for others. Tried to turn the other cheek, which I don't know how he did it sometimes.
After living quietly with cancer for almost 20 years, so quietly that even those close to him didn't recognize what was happening, he died at home, comforted by the family he'd created in America and the faith he'd carried from Italy.
That's writer Alyssa Eli remembering Carmen Barletta, who died a year ago this month at the age of 79. You can suggest someone for Remembrance. Email us at remember@wbur.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A warning before we continue, this next segment, which will last through the end of today's show, may not be appropriate for all listeners. The new documentary, I Am Jane Doe, tells the stories of victims of American child sex trafficking. What happens to these children is shocking. Here's Seattle lawyer Eric Bauer describing what happened to a young person he represents.
She was right out of seventh grade, and she was trafficked for a long time and very heavily, getting raped on a daily basis by upwards of 20 adults a day, having at these seventh grade kids any way they want. And that happens, and it's real.
It's real, and it's everywhere due to the internet. And as one mother in the film says, it's due to one company in particular.
For the company that assisted by advertising my 13-year-old child for sale, they were not held responsible. Backpage.com.
Backpage.com is the second largest online classified site in the United States, second only to Craigslist. A 2017 U.S. Senate report found that Backpage.com supports the vast majority, some 80% of all sex advertising online. Much of it is legal, but as the documentary reveals, there are hundreds of thousands of young children who are trafficked on the site. And several of those young victims and their families are trying to hold Backpage.com accountable. They've sued the company, and one of those lawsuits originated here in Boston. Three young Jane Does took their case all the way to the United States Supreme Court. But earlier this month, the nation's highest court decided not to hear their case, so a lower court ruling stands. It found that Backpage.com is not liable for the content on the site, but the Jane Does are not giving up their fight. Mary Mazzio is the filmmaker behind I Am Jane Doe, and when she first heard about the lawsuits, she was shocked that child sex trafficking in America is not hidden or uncommon.
Right, and so when I first found out about it, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to, like, dive into the deep web. Well, it was just a click away on Backpage.com, and there it was in its full glory. It is unmistakable what's happening.
Well, I referenced the Senate report that just came out. It was very, very recent. It calls Backpage the largest commercial sex services advertising platform in the United States and says that Backpage officials have publicly acknowledged that criminals use the website for sex trafficking, including the trafficking of minors. So it's known.
It's known. And Backpage has been very, very smart from a business standpoint. They have created a website that is finely honed, and it's very customer friendly. Backpage has heretofore been protected by federal judges, special interest groups, the tech community, and it stems from a law that really was enacted when the internet was beginning. It's called Section 230 of the ironically named Communications Decency Act. Section 230 was intended to shield online websites that if you didn't create the content and you in good faith tried to filter it, you ought to bear no culpability. And so Backpage has taken that to a whole new level.
Well, let's talk about that for a second because, I mean, what's going on here specifically regarding the trafficking of minors?
Right.
And as you put it, I think we should put it, you know, bluntly, bought and sold. These are minors who are being bought and sold for sex trafficking.
And repeatedly raped.
Yeah.
That's what's going on. These are 13, 14, 15-year-old girls that have engaged in these lawsuits. These are children,
yeah.
And it is modern-day slavery.
I mean, it's disgusting and it's criminal. But in the documentary, you talk about how Backpage has facilitated or helped users sort of skirt the law by modifying their posts in a way?
So it's really fascinating. They created this website that at first I think they tried to legitimately filter content.
Mm-hmm.
And you see internal memos saying if you see the word young in an ad, let's report it to the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Let's report it. 2 days later, we're losing too much business. If it's young, let it through. And then over time you see this evolution. You delete the ad, right? There would be instructions to moderators only if you are very, very, very sure it is a minor. So what happened was there was an evolution over time around revenue. Let's call it what it is.
How much revenue are we talking about?
So the Senate reports that in 2015, the site was making in excess of $150 million a year. This is hidden in plain sight. And the fact that it has been able to really operate in an unfettered way has been remarkable. And the federal judiciary has protected Backpage at every step.
Sitting right next to you is the mother of one of the Jane Does in the Boston lawsuit. We're using a pseudonym, the same pseudonym that was used in the lawsuit, Mrs. Sarah Lowe. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your daughter.
My daughter is a very sweet, big heart, talented young woman, and she's just a great person, a great young lady.
How old was she when she was first exploited?
15.
What happened?
I dropped her off at her friend's house, and they were going to go to the mall together. And she had a time to be home, and she was to let us know when she was coming home because she was going on the T, and we would pick her up from the train station. And as hours had gone by, we were calling her. We couldn't get in touch with her. She wasn't answering her cell phone. We're texting her. I was trying to find her, calling the cell phone company, seeing if they can put a trace on her phone, doing things like the family locator on her phone, and it just had her everywhere, places that I couldn't figure out while she was in so many different places on her phone. I was looking up, like, her last phone calls, had gone online, checking her cell phone to see, like, who was the last person she called or who was the last person who called her. Two men I spoke with said that they got my daughter's phone number from Backpage. I had no idea what that was. I had gone online to see what Backpage was, and I searched up her phone number, and then that's where I saw pictures of my daughter. They were pretty much, you know, it was really inappropriate. I don't know how else to explain it, but there were pictures of her in underwear and a bra.
So this was all in less than 24 hours?
Yes. And we didn't hear from her until the next day, the next morning.
And when you did hear from her, what?
We started to get ready to go to the police station. And once we actually got outside to the car, my daughter texted us and said, "I'm in the house." So she'd been dropped off. And we didn't really know exactly what happened to her because she wouldn't talk to us or tell us what happened. So, you know, we still don't know where she was or who she was with. And we ended up bringing her to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and, you know, I can only imagine the frenzy of the hours that you were trying to figure out what happened to your daughter. And you said you had never heard of this thing called Backpage. Mm-hmm. But once you did, and you saw the ad, did you try to reach out to the company?
I did. I emailed them telling them to remove the pictures, that my daughter was a minor. And I had to email them several times to even get a response back from them. And they still didn't take the pictures down.
I can't even imagine what my response would be if I saw an ad like that for a child of mine.
Mm-hmm.
How did you respond to that?
Well, I was very angry. I was hurt. And I'm saying, how did this happen? Even the question, like, did she put these pictures on here herself? Because I didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
You know, and you just go through so many different emotions. But I mean, hurt mostly, you know, because even I know that the two people I had spoken to were grown men. I was so angry. I really was just so angry just to even think, like, how could this happen?
And you just dropped her off at the mall.
She was
the
going to the mall.
Normal thing in the world.
Just going to the mall, a good kid, a good 15-year-old kid, never in trouble, never gave us a hard time, just going to the mall with a friend, you know? And in between that time until the next morning, you know, we still, you know, you just don't even know. It happens so fast.
It's the blink of an eye, really.
Mm-hmm. It can happen to anyone, to any family. You know, my daughter comes from a family with a father and a mother and brothers who love her. And, you know, I was taking my daughter to a friend to go to the mall.
Now, forgive me for asking this, but when you took her to the hospital, did... And they examined her, right? Did they tell you what they were able to tell you about
anything
we
that
didn't
happened?
Really understand or know, because she wasn't talking to us, to me or to my husband. She wasn't really talking to anyone. So I did not fully understand what happened to my daughter until months later. And I found that out through the district attorney's office, because I started doing research on my own and gave everything that I found to the police. Yeah. And then they were able to find the person who put my daughter on Backpage.
So can you tell me, like, what did happen to her?
I know that she was picked up from her friend's house by two people, a man and a woman. She did ask to go home, and they wouldn't take her home.
Did she know who they were?
The only thing I know is she was introduced to them by someone else, and she, I believe, was talking to them online. Mm. They pretty much kidnapped her. They took her to a hotel where a man was waiting for her, and he raped her. And then they brought her home.
I'm so sorry. How's she doing today?
She's doing better, but it's been a rough road. You know, she suffers from depression, PTSD. She's been in and out of the hospital over time, but she's doing a lot better. Not so much to me, but she's able to talk about the issue where before she wouldn't. She was able to, you know, graduate high school. It was a rough road,
yeah.
You know, but getting her the help she needed and just really supporting her. This lawsuit really helped her a lot. It makes her feel, and the movie, you know, mm-hmm. It just makes her feel more like she's in control.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Mary, can I bring you back in here for a second?
I just want to say one thing, and that is your daughter was so lucky to have you. And that these mothers in the film, these children, as traumatized as they are the lucky ones, that they had mothers rescue, look for services, stand up and say, there needs to be accountability here. This crime happens to a huge percentage of children that are homeless, runaway, LGBTQ youth. Many of the young women in our film, we had a couple of children that were gone for 270 days. You know, 300 days over a year. That was the trauma that they experienced was incredible. The violence was horrific, and yet they all felt great blame.
And Mary, in the film, you actually speak with a former pimp. His name is Homer King, and he describes to you exactly how he used to lure girls away from their families. Here's a clip.
You used seduction, you used love. Did you...
I won't say love, but I use seduction.
What do you tell her to watch out for?
A guy that's talking about he's going to solve all your problems. Who in the world can do that?
Homer King, he was a trafficker, a pimp, a reformed pimp. He now counsels young girls on the warning signs. And he talked about how easy it was. And he looked at me and he said, you would be shocked what people would do for love. And I looked at him and he said, I have turned the daughters of doctors. He said, it is extraordinary how easy this is and how risk-free, particularly with technology. These pimps and traffickers, they're not on the street anymore.
Right.
Right. They are with the ruthless efficiency of technology. They are scheduling hour by hour. And these young women are going from hotel room to hotel room.
Scheduling hour by hour.
This is not once or twice a day. With this crime and with technology, these children are being scheduled, you know, on the hour, by the hour. So we have heard stories up to 20 times a day. We're hearing, you know, it's so gruesome.
Tell me a little bit more about, there's, in the movie you talk about this grooming or the targeting, just the way that that children are kidnapped, to use Mrs. Lowe's word, and then there are cases in which they're given drugs, and then that makes it impossible for them to leave because of
an addiction that's created? I mean, just tell me more about this process.
So we've learned that there are sort of four major tactics. Chat rooms are huge. You know, kids feel that people are their friends, that they can be trusted. Kids that are going through adolescence, I mean, these are really tumultuous times, right? And they'll meet somebody, hey, can you stay out a little bit later? Are you hungry? All the way to seduction. And seduction is by far the number one. Hey, you know, you're my first love. Many of these children, it's their first romantic relationship. They're virgins by and large. And what often happens is that these children they're injected with heroin. It's called the leash. Once these children are addicted, they are so easily controllable. I mean, it's effectively game over.
Mrs. Lowe, let me just turn back to you because mm-hmm. we started this conversation with Mary talking about Backpage's role mm-hmm. in all of this. And, I mean, that's what the lawsuit was about, too, as well. I just want to know personally what your reaction is to Backpage and, you know, other internet companies who broadly say, you know, we're looking to this extant law that says we're not responsible for the content on our website.
Sorry, I don't even know how to answer this question. For me personally, just when I emailed Backpage back and forth and telling them, my daughter is a minor, take her off of your website, take these pictures down. I still cannot understand. I don't know the words exactly. I tried not to even remember them, but just the way it was worded, you can clearly see that it was for sex, you know. And they have to be held responsible. They have to be held responsible because these kids are going through, it's torture. And my daughter's, you know, forever traumatized, even if she is getting older and she's doing better, but that's always something that she's going to have to live with. And they have to be held responsible. Something has to be done. I can't believe that there are laws that are set in place where kids can be sold and raped.
Yeah. Well, we should note that the lawsuit that the Boston Jane Does brought made it, you know, through the federal court system, but the United States Supreme Court has elected not to hear the case. So, Mary, what does that mean?
So it means that the decision of the First Circuit Court of Appeals, where, by the way, Justice Souter sat in, right, former U.S. Supreme Court judge, the First Circuit said a website operator can profit, can encourage, can participate in this federal crime. But because of Section 230, because it's third-party content, sorry. You, Jane Doe, you children lose.
I mean, is that the First Circuit's way of saying this is a problem that can't be solved in the court, that it has to go back to Congress?
Precisely. And of course, we have been speaking with members of Congress, and they said, how can federal judges be saying this is congressional intent? We never intended for this to happen. Congress has to step up and alter Section 230. And this is going to be a big fight because the tech companies have, for 20 years now, enjoyed this immunity, an expanded immunity for third-party content. And as far as I'm concerned, it's corporate welfare, right? It is a cost of doing business. If you have harm on your site and you are profiting from it and you're participating in it, it should be a business cost that you bear some amount of responsibility for that harm. We're not asking that the statute be wholeheartedly rewritten. We're just simply saying, if there's evidence of criminality, what are you going to do about it? That's the question.
Well, Mary Ma...
Can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
And that is for Sarah, for her daughter, for the other Jane Does to have stepped out in this fashion, it is unbelievably courageous. And I don't even think you're aware of sort of how heroic it is. But for your case, it never would have gotten the attention of Congress. So even though the federal judges have been ruling against these children, your action and your voice has carried forward on behalf of so many others. And I hope you know and realize that we're indebted to you.
Thank you.
Well, Mrs. Sarah Lowe is one of the mothers of one of the Jane Does who brought a case against Backpage.com. Mrs. Lowe, let me just echo that and say thank you so much for coming in here and sharing your story on the program today.
Thank you. Thank you for doing the story.
And Mary Mazzio, former lawyer and director of the documentary I Am Jane Doe. It opens again on February 10th. We'll have more information, lots more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. Mary, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you to Sarah.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.